Okay, folks, it's 11 a.m. in Las Vegas, 4 a.m. in Sydney, Australia, 6 a.m. in Auckland, New Zealand. But here in Columbus, it's 2 p.m. That means we have a BIOS UEFI talk. You might say, wow, that's arcane. That's crazy. How could you have a whole big presentation? Ian Santopietro from System 76 is going to enlighten us about this controversial yet very important topic as the art of computing moves forward. So, without further ado.
Thank you, Stephen. Yeah, so I'm Ian. I work at System 76. I'm the senior support tech there. I've been there for about 3 years. And with the exception of backlit keyboards, UEFI is probably the question I get in sales and support queues the most often. People are wondering, they ask, do your systems have UEFI? When are you guys getting UEFI? Why don't you use UEFI? What's your opinion on UEFI? Can UEFI take me to dinner? That sort of thing. I get a lot of hate about it. People are really worried that, you know, it's going to mess up their computer and stuff like that. For the record, all of our current products don't use UEFI, they just use BIOS. But more on that in a minute. So, UEFI, myth busted. What it is, what it does, and what exactly does it mean going from here on forward? So first off, let's start with BIOS, because everybody loves BIOS. No one seems to have any problems with it. Stands for Basic Input Output System. Some of this is probably review for some people here, but in case not, I'm going to glance over it all. Basically, it makes it possible for higher level software like the kernel and the hardware abstraction layer to talk to the hardware underneath. And basically, it initializes and tests the hardware out when the system boots, and then it provides a basic HAL for input output devices like keyboards and mice. Does some Visa stuff for the displays, all that kind of stuff. Funny, interesting fact, modern OSs don't even use this. It's completely unused. If you go back and use like DOS or something, some of those OSs use it, but modern OSs have no use for it. It's stored in ROM, so for the most part, what's on your system is all that's ever gonna be on your system. If you want anything else, you have to boot something. There's a couple exceptions to that, but one of the manufacturers is using flash ROM to store it so you can upgrade it. But still, upgrading your BIOS means you have to put a bunch of motherboards and like all this special fancy mode. It's not something you can do on the fly. So it's not expandable, and it hasn't really been changed since it was first introduced in 1975, which means that it's almost twice as old as I am, which is a scary thought. So what's UEFI then? It's also an acronym, because in computers we love acronyms. It stands for the Unified Extensible Firmware Interface. And you're probably picking out a couple of words in there, and you can probably figure out about what it does. It's a standardized firmware interface designed to eventually replace BIOS. Right now it kind of supplants it. And it's designed to improve software interoperability and to address a lot of the limitations that BIOS has. Basically, it presents a software layer on top of the firmware. And it is programmable and scriptable as well. It's actually sort of an API, and it provides an interface for applications, essentially, to run on top of. So, what UEFI is not. Here's the myth part. It is not developed by Microsoft. It's actually developed by Intel through a project called Tiano Core. It doesn't block Ubuntu or any other Linux distribution prior to what a lot of people seem to think. And it is not secure boot, which is the other big thing that people ask me about is, what's secure boot? They say, I don't want secure boot. And I say, great. And they say, so you don't have anything with BIOS, right? Or everything you have uses BIOS. And they're not related, or they're not the same thing, but they are related. We'll get to that in just a minute. So most importantly, it's not evil, I promise. I've played with it, I did a lot of stuff, and it's just fun. So why switch? You know, I mean, we have a BIOS that works, and it's old, but seems to work pretty well. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? Wrong. It takes a lot less time to boot. I have a laptop up here running UEFI, and when I press the power button, it gets through the BIOS in about a second, and then starts booting Ubuntu. And then because it has an SSD in it, that means that I can go from completely powered off to Ubuntu, a fully functional, high-level operating system in about 6 seconds, which is really fast. It also allows you to use GPT really, really well and natively. GPT is GUID partition tables, and that's a whole other presentation. But suffice it to say, you can address, you can use disks that are a lot larger than 2 terabytes, which is, again, really big. Right now, we're currently shipping drives that are up to 3 gigabytes in size because of that.
Terabytes. You said gigabyte.
Yeah, much bigger than 3 gigabytes. it also has 64-bit firmware device drivers, which means that basically all that code that runs the very low-level hardware is going to be running in native machine code. It's not going to need to be, it is taking full advantage of the hardware. And it can address more than 17.2 petabytes of RAM at boot. So right now with BIOS, you have some high memory and low memory limitations. And the BIOS can only address the first, you know, the low memory, its very first segment of RAM is very small. Not the case with EFI. It also stores all of the OS boot code on your hard drive, which means it's very, very flexible and easy to recover in the event that something like that gets erased or broken, something like that. And it contains a little tiny piece of software called the Compatibility Support Module, which makes it fully backwards compatible with BIOS and legacy OSs. So even if you're using an OS that doesn't support UEFI, you can still boot it on a UEFI system. So, I mentioned booting. How on earth does a computer boot right now using BIOS? So first, the BIOS initializes and tests all of the system hardware, every single piece, video cards, RAM, all of it. Takes a little while. Once it's certain that everything is absolutely okay, it checks the very first device in the bootloader and tries to load a boot order. Basically, it looks at the first sectors of the hard drive for what's called the master boot record. If it finds something, it'll run that, and if not, it skips to the next device for every device in the bootloader or in the boot order, which can be, you know, quite a few devices depending on you know, how your computer is set up. In the master boot record is something called phase one, which is actually too small to load modern OSs. They take a little bit more work to get them all in there, and maybe have to send kernel options and stuff like that, especially in Ubuntu. So all phase one loads is more bootloader. So the bootloader is just basically booting another bootloader in the form of what's called phase two. If you're familiar with Grub, especially the old school Grub 1, you remember the stage 1, stage 1.5, stage 2, that's all that this stuff was. Phase 2 contains the meat of the bootloader code, which includes like the menu that you choose, the little editor, I know Bash has a shell, and all the code that actually sticks the OS and puts it in the RAM. And all that is stored in phase 2. It doesn't go anywhere else. Phase 2 sets up the RAM, decompresses the kernel image into high memory. Remember that high-low memory bit. And then finally executes kernel startup. And the rest, as they say, is history. Or at least the rest is in it. I was waiting for someone. I'm glad I got a couple laughs there. So what's different with UEFI? Well, it still has to initialize the hardware, and it does some checks to make sure that it's all working, because if the hardware's not working, booting the OS can lead to more hardware problems. So that's kind of dangerous. But then, it looks up the EFI program, which is just basically pointed to in a little setting in the system RAM, basically. It tells it which partition to look at on the disk, and loads the code off of there as an EFI program, and runs it. By default, it will also boot from a hard-coded default location, which is just for recovery, basically. If there's nothing else there, it has something to boot so that systems will boot even if they don't have, you know, if they've not been set up, basically. And then it runs the program, and that's about all it does, and that's all it needs to do. So for Linux and Ubuntu and, you know, OSs that we all like, those programs are things like grub is an EFI program now. It's the EFI programs that take care of running the OS, essentially. But they can do lots of other things too. They can run more EFI programs. The EFI shell, which is a basic recovery tool, is all it basically does is run more EFI programs. They can browse the internet, they have device drivers, they can represent a traditional bootloader like grub or Lilo, which is how Ubuntu currently boots. Fun, interesting fact though, well, first of all, let's remember that it is extensible, and that's where that comes in, is you can write these programs and expand your interface without needing to, you know, rewrite all of your OS or all of your firmware code. You don't have to put the BIOS and the motherboard into flashing mode in order to rewrite any of this stuff. It just kind of does it. So even the kernel has a little tiny EFI program built into it, a little stub, and it's an option on the kernel mainline, but most kernels, I think, now include it when they're shipped with an OS. I know that Ubuntu does. And that kernel, that stub, just basically loads the kernel that it's embedded into. So you can run the kernel from an EFI prompt or from an EFI loader already, and basically the kernel loads itself without using grub or Lilo or anything like that, which I think is really cool. Absolutely.
So, do we do that?
Yes, we do. You do.
Okay, so if... So I confused UEFI with Secure Boot, so I bought a new laptop, turned everything off, and then installed it.
Uh-huh.
So you're saying that, so do we even need the init stuff? Can it just go straight from UEFI and the kernel's like...
So init is what boots, it's what the kernel loads to actually start the OS up, so you'd still need init.
Okay.
But what this would cut out is grub, essentially. The kernel literally loads itself.
I didn't know we could do that.
Yeah, no, I did that on my Penguin, actually. It was really pretty cool.
How is this different from DOS U-Boot?
U-Boot?
Which is on the ARM side of things.
I'm not familiar with ARM. It's my understanding that UEFI is similar to the sort of firmware interface that ARM provides, but I'm not a real big expert on that. I didn't do a lot of research on the ARM side of things because that's a whole other world. ARM is very, very different, and as soon as you start looking at RISC stuff, it's just risky. So then there's just as much misinformation there as there's with UEFI, so I picked a topic and kind of stuck with it. In the back?
Yeah, is it true that with UEFI, the Windows key is stored in the BIOS? Or in the UEFI itself?
That's specific to Secure Boot, and I'll get back to that in a minute when I cover the Secure Boot stuff. And by the way, I know it's probably apparent now, but if anybody has any questions at any time, feel free to interrupt me and I'll answer them up for you. What's up?
So does the kernel have to have that EFI stub to not need grub?
Yes, it will need to have the stub. Most distributions will pre-compile the stub in there. It's an option during kernel compilation. I know that the Ubuntu kernel does because, I mean, I've done it a couple times. It's really cool to watch it do it. It's very neat, but anyway. Richard?
Can you, pause the boot and pass different options to the kernel?
Not dynamically, but what you can do is load an EFI shell where you just specify the commands and the parameters right there. Ideally, if you needed to pass different options, you pick the options that you need the most often. Like, you know, if you want a recovery mode, you know, If you want a recovery mode option, you just tell it to, you know, take out quiet splash and then add the single option so that it boosts to recovery mode. You know, that's all that Grub does. And it's not quite as interactive, or, you know, you could even have a copy of Grub that you could load as well. You know, and by default it would load the kernel, but if you needed to specify different parameters, you could go through Grub. So there's a lot of different options for that present. Anyway, so going on, UEFI sounds great, right? It's really not as bad as a lot of people thought. When can I get it on my computer? Most modern computers made after, say, 2010 should have a UEFI setting in the BIOS. You'll have to excuse me. My mom gave me a cold before I flew out here, so my voice seems to be disappearing on me. So check in your BIOS for a setting labeled UEFI. That one does not have it, I'm sorry. it may be labeled Legacy Boot or Legacy OS. Look for stuff with Legacy in it, not Legacy USB. But anything else that says Legacy is probably related to UEFI. And make sure that that's just set to enable. Most of them already do. A lot of them now that Windows 8 is actually a horrendous thing, is actually supported out of the box and is turned on. If you happen to be a System 76 customer, because you're awesome, current generation System 76 products are UEFI ready right now, and it can be enabled. And if you need help with that, you can come by our booth tomorrow and we'll help you out. Absolutely.
You mentioned that Intel was kind of the driving force behind this.
Yep.
Is this present as often on AMD processors?
Yes. So Intel develops the API for UEFI. It's up to the motherboard manufacturer to actually implement it. And so that will vary from manufacturer to manufacturer. There's all a minimum of things that they have to support, and then they can build other stuff into it. It's not necessarily tied to Intel or AMD as far as the actual processor manufacturer.
So do you know if Apple is supporting it?
Apple currently uses EFI, which is very, 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 very similar, except it's a little bit more pure. Oh, thank you. And I'm not 100% familiar with Apple stuff, but suffice it to say that when I was doing all of my initial testing with UEFI on my computer, I played around and actually managed to load Refit on a non-Apple computer, which some people think is really cool. I thought it was kind of interesting. And thank you, Emma, for the water. So yeah, come by our booth. We'll get it. We'll help you out. Which brings us to everybody's favorite topic, secure boot. What is secure boot? Secure boot is a protocol implemented as a feature within UEFI. So it's generally an option. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it comes pre-enabled, and you can't turn it off. Sometimes it's an option. It basically secures the boot process by preventing loading unsigned bootloaders, code, drivers. Basically, if it wants to load out of UEFI, it has to be signed with a key to make sure it's valid. It's similar to if you have an Android phone, you can unlock it. That's basically turning off the ARM sort of implementation of secure boot, which allows you to load custom ROMs and unsigned code. It prevents rootkit attacks from infecting the boot code, and those sorts of attacks would be, the OS wouldn't really be able to detect them. I mean, most of them now wouldn't be able to anyway. Which means that the inability to load alternate OSs isn't a side effect of secure boot, because those alternate OSs aren't necessarily signed. But it's not the intention of secure boot. I know a lot of people like to point fingers and blame, but trust me, Microsoft is not trying to lock you out of using Ubuntu. They're only trying to make Mr. I want to go to Best Buy and buy a computer person safe with using their computer and not let it get messed up.
If Microsoft's not trying to block it out, why do they say that the motherboard must be turned on for the UEFI to be Windows certified?
The reason they're doing that is they want to make sure that it's safe for those sorts of people. And I'm sure you know the kind of people I'm talking about. It's like old people that aren't technologically savvy. If I had a nickel for every technologically unsavvy person in the country, I could afford to buy a car, damn near. So there's a lot of people that have no idea what they're doing as far as computers are concerned, and you don't want to have an opt-in to protect the sheeple.
Yeah, but Microsoft's going further because they control the motherboard. They tell them what they have to make. Maybe that's a little strong, but I think there are a lot of motherboard manufacturers that intentionally did that. So
well, if you're like, hey, we're going to do secure boot, and you're a motherboard manufacturer, you're like, dude, that's more stuff I got to add. It's going to cost me more money. Why would I do that? I'll just leave it off, or I'll implement it and leave it off. It's like, okay, fine, leave it off. You don't get the Windows certification little sticker. Then that forces them to pay attention, right?
Basically, they want to make it so that when this technologically unsavvy person buys a computer from a Best Buy or from Dell.com or whatever, they have the most secure experience out of the box. Personally, I don't think that secure boot is the best way to solve the problem that they're trying to solve. And a lot of the ways to get around secure boot and boot Ubuntu right now, or other Linux OSs, actually sort of circumvent secure boot entirely by only signing the bootloader, which can then load unsigned kernel images. It makes it a hell of a lot easier for distributors to ship an OS, but it kind of defeats the whole point of having secure boot in the first place. So, I mean, there's security reasons for it, and I'm not going to try and say that it's good, because quite frankly, I don't think that's true. I mean, I've seen it, and it just doesn't seem like the right way to do it. But there are other people who disagree with me, and they're entitled to their opinions, and if they want to make sure that the computer is secure, they can take whatever steps they want to. It's really up to the consumer whether or not they want to buy that particular product.
How do you feel about the saying that the only secure computer is the one that has its rusty hard drive encased in cement and is at the bottom of the Ohio River?
I bet you someone find a way to crack that too.
Okay.
I mean, seriously, computers are just sort of inherently insecure, and there's a lot of things that you can do to make that better. This is one particular approach to that problem. And data is a huge business. I mean, that's why Google exists, essentially, because they control a lot of data. And making sure that data is safe is the primary focus for any company that deals with it. I know that we deal a lot with data internally, especially with sensitive data like addresses and contact information and credit card numbers. And it's very, very difficult to make sure that all of that is safe and secure and so that it can't be accessed by someone who would do bad things with it, or could do bad things with it. You have to keep it very contained.
Does secure boot support NVR partitions, or is it only strictly GPT?
I'm relatively certain that UEFI as a whole doesn't support NVR all that well. Secure boot is probably going to be GPT only. That said, of all the people I've talked to, no one thinks that GPT is a bad thing. I mean, it really isn't. I mean, I had a point there where I had 15 primary partitions on my hard drive, and there wasn't really a reason for it, but it was kind of cool to be like, hey, look, I have 15 primary partitions on my hard drive. That's kind of cool, right? Geek bragging, right, sort of, so to speak. I don't think that UEFI does support NVR. I'm not 100% certain on that. But at the same time, why would you want to use MDR in the first place? It's sort of the counter question there. It's about as old as BIOS, and there's no real reason to use it over GPT. There's no encryption benefit or anything like that, and every modern OS that I know of does support GPT.
The only reason why is because our cooling solution that we use where I work at, it doesn't fully support GPT yet. So we ordered 135 computers, and they all came with Windows 7 with GPT partitions. And because we couldn't clone with the GPT partition, I had to convert it back to the master boot record. But the secure boot feature seemed like something I wanted to implement anyways. That's why I wasn't sure if you could do that with MDR.
I don't think you can. And honestly, I would try, if you can't find a different cloning solution, I would raise it with the software developer of that one, that GPT support is coming to be a must-have.
Well, it's fog.
Okay.
I'm pretty involved with the community, but I don't know, it's not coming along as well as fast as I would like it, at least. So I'm going to resort to older technologies.
We implemented GPT on all of our systems about 6 months ago, and we actually had to write an entirely new imaging system to do it. But suffice it to say, it has paid off. And GPT is just it's so many worlds better that not using it is sort of a downside at this point. Link, you had a question?
Well, I was gonna say most OSs that have if you set the MBR use an MBR type partition. It'll load up. It won't load the UEFI. It'll set the master boot record, so it kind of doesn't matter. The operating system probably won't support MBR with UEFI.
Right. Well, yeah, I think you're right there. It's also going to be dependent on the OS to support that combination as well.
I know Windows 7 and Windows 8 don't, and I'm pretty sure Ubuntu doesn't.
Windows 8 is kind of weird. If you're going to be installing in UEFI mode, you do have to use GPT, but if you're installing in BIOS mode, you have to use MBR, and Ubuntu's not like that. Which, by the way, we do have a System 7.6 product. I'm very sorry if it's recent, but you can't install Windows on it because it's using GPT. Not that that's a problem, because I don't think anybody here wants to use Windows, but I wouldn't blame them. Anyway, so, moving on. In any case, Secure Boot and UEFI aren't necessarily linked. One is a feature of the other, but you can have UEFI without having Secure Boot. It's entirely dependent on the OEM making your product to support it. If they don't implement it, then you're basically home free. There's nothing that they can do to force you to use it. Apart from, you know, making it not a setting, you know, just turning it on and then hiding the setting in the configuration. You have to enable Secure Boot to ship a computer with Windows 8. You know, if you want to actually send computers out and put Windows 8 on them and sell them. You have to enable Secure Boot just because of the Windows 8 requirements. But we're not talking about Windows here. This is a Linux conference. We're talking about Ubuntu, and Ubuntu does not require Secure Boot, at least not yet. Over there.
So what if you want to cold boot and the machine, maybe the machine can work with Windows 8 on it? Can you dual boot with Ubuntu?
You can. On a lot of systems, you can disable the secure boot without disabling UEFI, and you can dual boot that way. That said, I've seen a lot of... I've played around with a couple of Windows 8 systems, and they're very, very difficult. A lot of them have some UEFI stuff to make sure that any changes you make to the boot code get reverted, and it boots only Windows. So there's going to be a lot of other issues there, too. I'm not a big expert on Windows. I haven't used it in about 7 years, so
Yeah, I just was wondering because sometimes if people have one computer and you're like, oh, you should try this other operating system, they're like, yeah, but I still have to use this other crappy one for work. Like, what do I do? Mm-hmm. I think it makes it more difficult to be like, well, try it on the side at first. You know what I mean? So
absolutely.
I still think that's a real problem that it's you know, it would be maybe your mind here gets to be like, screw Windows, I'll never use it again. But
if I were getting that question in the support, I would probably say your best bet is probably to do a virtualized copy of Windows within Ubuntu, which is going to let you run Windows natively and run Windows apps natively without running into anything like that. Over here, with Goss.
Easy BCD lets you rebuild the bootloader with both of them in it, and basically what it does is it boots to the Windows 8, and then if you select the Ubuntu one, it basically just reboots the computer and boots into that, but it initially boots. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But Easy BCD lets you change it so that it works with both.
Okay. Yeah, there's a couple of ways that you can do that too. I know that most OSs that support UEFI, especially Linux OSs, you can actually set up a grub copy in there as well and be able to boot either UEFI mode or BIOS mode, just depending on how the BIOS is set. So, in that.
I have the laptop that shipped with Windows 8 that I added Linux to, and I'm happy to show it to you.
Okay, so he basically said, just to reiterate for the recorder, that he bought a computer with Windows 8 and you added Ubuntu to it.
Linux,
okay. So he added a Linux distro to it and they play nice together without any problems, right? Mostly. Mostly.
I'm happy to show it to you.
Perfect. There we go. So go see this gentleman if you have any questions about how they play together. Could have sworn I saw another one up here.
Okay, I'm not a system administrator or familiar with booting, but I've been reading about this issue with Secure Boot and I'm very confused. So my understanding is that if you buy a computer that has Windows 8 on it, the Secure Boot is enabled, and you can't disable that, you can't get rid of Windows 8 from that system, or does that depend on the hardware manufacturer?
You can get rid of Windows 8. I mean, nothing's stopping you from wiping your hard drive. If you do that, though, the system won't boot, so you have to be kind of careful with that. I do know that Ubuntu specifically is shipping a UEFI copy of their OS with a copy of Grub that's been signed by with a Microsoft key, so that it looks as far as the secure boot is concerned, it is Windows, and I correct me if I'm wrong on that, because I might be.
What?
But Ubuntu shipping a Microsoft signed Grub in EFI, right?
I like 95% sure.
Higher.
Yeah, 12.10 and higher. So you can boot Ubuntu on a system that has secure boot, but that's going to be a lot more dependent on
because Microsoft lets them.
Right? They've let Canonical sign Grub with their key. And it's going to be dependent on the specific OS distributor to get that signed and be able to distribute that, because I don't think you can do it otherwise.
So the signature is not, is it like machine code where you couldn't just cut and paste it from Ubuntu and put it on a
No, it's similar to if you sign a file, like when you sign the Ubuntu Code of Conduct, for example. You generate a signature, and then you basically, it's sort of like encrypting it.
It's not human readable.
It's like when you get an email and it says begin PGP signed message. Mm-hmm. It just verifies that that the sender of the message is who they say they are. It's the same kind of thing here.
So when somebody cracks Microsoft's key, the whole thing goes to junk, right?
Yes, I believe Microsoft's key is I'm not sure. Do you know what?
We're going to live long enough to see that, right?
How do you know that? All right.
That's why you boomed it, yeah.
But,
NSA?
Needless to say, encryption's difficult to crack. And if you're good at that,
well, it's not
more
cracking, it's just getting it. Yeah. You don't have to crack it.
Well, if someone leaks the key, yeah, but then they can just make a new key. And
except
then,
for all those motherboards that are out there.
They might have stuff on there updated. I'm not 100% familiar on that.
I'm not clear about how this is not an effort by Microsoft to tell consumers what they can do with their computers.
Yes.
I'm not convinced.
No.
This is definitely. No. I mean,
Microsoft has the cloud to get their key put into everybody's UEFI.
Microsoft is in
the small Linux people and smaller groups don't have that cloud. It's still not Microsoft trying to keep everybody out.
It's Microsoft trying to make computers more secure in a way that, as a side effect, blocks the ability to do all that other stuff. It, you know, for all I know, it could be Steve Ballmer sitting in his office going, block Linux, block Linux, block Linux, block Linux, and getting really mad and sweaty.
throwing chairs again.
Yeah, it very well could be.
I think it is a good feature. I want when I buy a laptop from System76, I want to make sure that the OS that is booting is the one that was signed by whoever.
Right.
Whoever on the kernel team is responsible for saying, you know, we have checked this.
This
is the official, you know.
Yeah, it is a good feature, and it can be used to make sure that the code you're booting is not going to wreck your system.
I understand that, but when you get a piece of hardware and it says it has this system on it, you don't want that system anywhere on the system, on your computer, but you can't get rid of it. You have to use it.
Well,
you're free to buy whatever you want.
Exactly. That's kind of how it boils down. And most of, it's my understanding that most of the computers out there that do ship with Secure Boot offer it as an option in the BIOS, so you can disable it if you don't want it.
You can disable it, and then you can
leave. Right. There's nothing that Microsoft says that says you have to enable Secure Boot and it can't be disabled.
Okay, you said earlier that sometimes it can be.
That's up to the OEM.
Okay.
Right. And for the record, we at System76 won't be enabling Secure Boot, at least not in the foreseeable future. It might be available as an option in there, and you can set it up and use it if you want to. If we do start enabling it, we're going to be using publicly available keys so that you can sign whatever OS you want to run. And that would allow you basically to control your Secure Boot and make sure that the OS that you're booting is valid and, you know, not tampered with, and it's exactly the OS that you intended to run on it.
One thing I will chip in, Ian, is this. When it comes to x86 platform, Secure Boot can be disabled, and it's an opt-out feature primarily so that when you have Joe Sixpack go buy it, yes.
It's safe out of the box.
Yeah, it's safe out of the box. That's the key intent. You don't want a Sony rootkit or the like. The only time you cannot disable it, there is one point in the Microsoft spec on their hardware where you can't. It's ARM. And right now, ARM is in an interesting state of affairs. First and foremost, Microsoft's ARM tablets, the ones they have sold, the Surface RT, you may have heard of them.
You probably haven't.
Yeah.
Because they're not selling very well.
Yeah. The only way you've ever heard of them is through Mary Jo Foley's reporting that they're not selling well. Those are the ones where you cannot disable Secure Boot. You cannot put Ubuntu Touch on them. You can't put Android on them. You can't do anything with them except use Windows 8.
RT, which has nothing to do with
it. Yeah, and RT is basically locked down.
Windows with no apps.
Yeah. Windows with no apps. Wonderful. Wonderful, great system. But that's an edge case. That's the one corner case you get. Now, there was talk at one point you could have multiple key registrars. Is this a perfect solution? No. Does it reflect the very messy marketplace we've got? Yes. Yes, it does. Just as much, if you've heard the analogy I gave earlier about starting out with a tank and instead of moving from that down to a Volvo, going to a Hummer, we don't expect everyone to be a tank driver to be able to field strip and repair the tank as they go. Secure boot is the way of saying, okay, we don't expect you to even be able to drive standard. We expect you to handle automatic transmission. We reasonably expect the car not to explode. We expect the engine to work. And here you go. We also expect you to not mess with the engine block at all to try to do anything with it. And if you get a Chrysler, I mean Fiat, as they're known these days, you might get that. But there are other routes you can go. But it's that kind of answer of, it's a solution to a mass market situation that grew up organically, whether we like it or not. Yeah, it gets in our way, but I don't know if we can get around it being necessary for the mass market.
It's hard. The user experience sucks. Yeah. You ever try to help someone do a UEFI dual boot with Windows 8? It's horrible. It's like building the kernel is easier, I think.
Yes. Exactly. It basically boils down to the entire philosophy of opt-in settings versus opt-out settings. Anytime you make something an opt-in, you're alienating a very large portion of your user base who are never going to dig through the settings and find out that that's even there. If you make it opt-in, you can provide them, or opt-out, you can provide them the best experience out of the box while enabling advanced users like all of us to still control, you know, their end experience. So I have a bunch of questions popping up here. I'm going to try and answer them in the order I saw them. I think we're here first.
You said UEFI is on the hard drive?
UEFI is built into the firmware and the motherboard of the system,
okay.
But so the boot code...
It's on the chip. Then.
The actual UEFI is, but it loads boot code that's stored on it. On the hard drive, all the UEFI programs that you can run, including the loaders and, you know, I'm sure there's a UEFI web browser out there.
So secure boot's on the chip also.
Right. Back here.
Is the problem here with secure boot that it's a Microsoft specification where they hold the keys? I mean, did you say that they have given other entities the ability to sign it? I mean, that's
yeah.
The problem if there's a central authority.
Yeah.
I'm asking. Sounds like this technology could actually benefit the FOSS community.
It absolutely could.
If somebody doesn't like want to do SHA-1 hashes on every bit of code they put on their computer, they can just say, my computer's running this canonical, they put it on their repositories, and this is known good software, much like the people in the FOSS community.
Right. Ideally, the best implementation of Secure Boot would be one where you can upload a key into the firmware, and then when you go to install an OS, you get a key from Canonical or from Microsoft or from Red Hat or from SUSE that gives you, basically you load that into the firmware, and then the code that they give you is signed so that when you go to load it, it verifies the integrity of whatever you're loading. And that's kind of how Canonical does it right now. I know that they have like their own key for UEFI, don't they? Their own secure boot key?
I would say have that only because Microsoft and their grace message have decided. Is Microsoft the central authority for this secure boot that we're talking
not
about?
Not their secure boot. Not secure boot. They are right now because all of the machines are shipping, all the machines with secure boot are shipping with Windows 8. And that's a Microsoft product, so they have to be the central authority for Microsoft products. But Canonical would be the central authority for Canonical products, and Red Hat would be the central authority for Red Hat products.
Oh, so it's like the secure. If you just buy a motherboard that has secure boot on it, mm-hmm. It doesn't already pre-program with Microsoft as a central authority.
No, it ships in a setup mode, and then you install the keys that you want in it, and then you lock it down so that it can't be changed.
Okay, yeah.
You being a manufacturer, not an engine.
OEMs.
You being the manufacturer or user or whatever. And that's problems with the current UEFI implementation and the current secure boot implementation is you can't change it after you install it. So I saw some questions over here. In green?
Yeah, my big question was basically this. If you're not a builder, okay, and you want to buy an off-the-shelf computer, it's going to have Windows 8 on it. It's your responsibility to look at the OEM manufacturer and make sure that you have the option to opt out of secure boot when you buy that system, correct?
Yeah, and that's an excellent point. A lot of the problems with secure boot can be avoided by being a smart consumer. And smart consumers are great. I personally love them. You know, I love it when people call me and ask me sales questions because I know that they're going to be happier with their computer. So
I'm a builder, but I was just putting that out there for the people who don't build.
Right.
You know, so that they know they can, if they do a little research, they don't have to worry about not being able to load Ubuntu or Linux Mint or anything like that onto an off-the-shelf computer.
Right, right.
Problems when somebody becomes smart after they buy a computer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
During this discussion, there's been an implicit assumption that all these issues are about installing an alternate OS onto the hard drive. How does this change the dynamics with live CDs or US Google keys or Pixie boots or like that? Who does it?
Anything that the UEFI is loading has to be signed. So it would have also affect live CDs, USB drives, network boots. If it's going to boot on the computer, it has to be signed using the secure boot key, if secure boot is enforced.
But just if secure boot were not enforced, then anything goes?
Right, you could turn it off and then boot whatever you want. So I had a question over here.
Everybody you worry about, they can't boot with secure boot and Windows 8, but isn't it true now that the Linux Foundation is a member of UEFI, and there are ways to boot self-signed kernels? You can compile your own self-signed kernel and public key to boot.
Yes, and you can do that and run it without any problems. The issue is most people either don't know how or don't want to compile a kernel.
It's very new. It was just posted on Greg Hartman's blog. He's a kernel maintainer. He gave a tutorial on how to do it. Now, it's coming along. It's not easy to do by any means, but I'm sure down the road that this isn't going to be as big a problem now that it is now.
You're saying if I Windows RT tablet, I can put Linux on one of those?
No, that's...
I don't know that for a fact, but you can sign your own kernel down. You don't have to use, like, you're saying Microsoft controls it because even Canonical has to use Microsoft's key. That's not necessarily true. You can compile your own self-signed.
How come I can't install Ubuntu on an RT tablet?
That's because it's ARM.
Isn't there an ARM version of Ubuntu?
Yeah, but the device itself is locked.
So,
like, you know, on your that's what I'm saying, the device is locked.
But that's Microsoft's specific product. That's not necessarily secure boot itself. That's a product choice that Microsoft, as an OEM,
they
made.
They did it through secure boot, didn't they?
Yeah. Right, but
on ARM, not on X86 or on.
Well.
It's their own hardware. They control it as.
Exactly, and
just like you can't load Ubuntu on an iPad.
Right.
Yeah, it's exactly like exactly that. It's the same exact plan.
Is the lesson learned.
And the gentleman over here in the green basically brought up a great point in that you can make sure that there's not going to be any problems by buying hardware that you know can be unlocked. So the simple solution to that is don't buy a Surface RT. I mean, it's not a great device anyway. And I know I'm obviously a little bit biased because I've worked for a competitor, but.
I think a lot of people are taking that advice already.
Exactly. The people have voted with their wallets in favor of unlockable products. Products that aren't necessarily unlocked from the factory, but that can be unlocked by the user afterwards. Any other quick questions? Start running out of time.
Does EFI have any knowledge to it in firmware or completely independent product?
Open firmware like Core Boot or open firmware like what Max used to use?
Max and Spark.
I don't know very much at all about open firmware. so I'm not the right person to ask about that.
Does UEFI have programming language in it?
Yes, it has. It's all actually C, I think, and it's basically just a special compiler which is provided for free by Intel, and an API that you can use to plug into UEFI itself.
It's not embedded in the machine.
It is. I mean, the runtime type of stuff. The API is embedded into the machine, and then there's an SDK that you can download. It's the Tiano Core SDK, basically. It lets you write EFI programs that'll plug into the EFI implementation on a specific machine. And it's all EFI, so you can run these same programs on a modern Mac that uses EFI too. Right.
I just booted up into my BIOS. What is AHCI?
AHCI has to do with hard drives. You should leave that enabled.
Okay.
Because if you disable it, it might not boot. Anyway, so I think that's about it. I'm going to hand it back over to Stephen here.
All right.